check out beacons.ai/comicsfunprofit for all the C4 FAP links you could ever need, all in one place. You can provide feedback, listen, support, share, enjoy these. We have our Patreon there. You can buy us a beer or a coffee. You can check out our Instagrams, our Twitters, our Facebooks. Check out our YouTube page. You can email us. You can listen to our podcasts on Patreon, if you're a subscriber, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, on Podbean. We have Google Podcasts on there. We have an Amazon wish list. You want to buy Kyle and I something? Fine. You can do that here. We appreciate it. We have Kyle's RPG podcast listed on there, so you can check out his Dork Day Afternoon offerings. We have Cowabunga links, so you can check out the Cowabunga deep discount FOC and pre-order list. Get on that. That's RLCS, so you can check that out as well. And we want to just give you opportunities to say hi, to check out what we're doing, support us if you would like, or just listen. Check out beacons.ai/comicsfunprofit for all the C4 FAP links you could ever need. Thanks. Back to the show.
Aloha. This is Jason from Hawaii. Welcome to a special edition of the Comics for Fun and Profit podcast. In this episode, I will be interviewing British fantasy award-winning writer-artist I.N.J. Cobard. He is here to promote his latest work. Now, people can pronounce it either Salamandre, or I'm going to try to pronounce the French word, and I.N.J., just correct me if I'm wrong, Salamandre. Salamon.
Yeah, I do it really badly. So don't worry about it.
If you please forgive me, I'm going to stick to the Salamandre. I think
that's cool.
Yes, okay. Now, this book is part of the Karen Berger Books. It is an imprint through Dark Horse Comics. This is an original graphic novel that is now available at your local comic shops right now. I.N.J., welcome to the Comics for Fun and Profit podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me.
No, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask you, may I ask, what does I.N.J. stand for?
I never tell anyone.
Okay, that's fine.
I make it up every single time.
I'm joking.
Nicodemus Jeremiah, it could be anything. Everybody knows the beginning is Ian, but I've never liked that name. So.
Okay. I'm just making a joke. So at conventions, do you put a little sign say, pay me $10 and I'll really tell you what I had chased? Yeah.
I should do, because I make a lot of money because I'd never tell them. So yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. All right. And then I'm just gonna ask again, before we started the interview, your book, I'm trying to find the correct pronunciation, but I'm gonna do the American version. I know I call it Salamandre. Again, may I ask, can you pronounce the French version again? The French,
Salamandre.
Okay.
So Salamandre.
Okay. And then, of course, as we talked about, it's French. And then I'm going to ask, what is the meaning of the title?
Well, it's the surname of the character in the book. It's the surname of the character in the book, but it's just a salamander. But the reason for having the name as it is because I grew up bilingually, speaking English and Polish. And I think a lot of people, as I was growing up, they used to think that I kind of translate on the fly in my head when I go to one and I go to the other, but I don't. It's just an extended vocabulary. That's all it is. And what I was trying to convey was the way in which how I perceive being bilingual. And I was trying to show a way that actually kind of looks. So what it is you see a word, it's not spelt quite the same way, but you know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I could do that quite a bit with the English language, because the English language is, if I said to you vocabulaire français, you know that I've just said French vocabulary.
Right? Pretty much, yes.
If I say nécessaire, then you know it's necessary, right? It's like there's a heck of a lot of our own language that's actually French, so we already speak a chunk of it. So it would be easy. We also know, like, internationally, we know things like s'il vous plaît or qu'est-ce que c'est, or, you know, there's a lot of stuff that filter through internationally. And so I figured, okay, well, I'll just use a lot of French words that we kind of already know. What I won't do is, you know, because there was this thing in the 60s where in France, where they were talking about this thing called franglais, which is basically taking English words and making them sound French. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to use actual French words and make people realize, you know what this means, right? When you see it. So when we see the title, you know it's a salamander. So you could call it salamander. You could say salamandre, but effectively, you know, that's pretty much, that was the thinking behind it. And that's the thinking behind why the book has like a French theme going through it. So they say merci, they say au revoir, things like that. But they're all things we know as English speakers. So that was the thing I wanted to establish, a sense of culture and a sense of history as well, because you'll get characters in it who speak nothing but French, but they tend to be an older generation. So the aunt that's in the attic, she's calling out to him for water. So she's saying, "Lo, lo." And he thinks she's saying, "Hello, hello."
Right.
So it's me, like, because "lo" is not something we would identify as being water, right? If you're an English speaker straight away. So it is about a generational language as well. It allowed me to kind of, in a world building sense, it allowed me to give the world almost an immediate sense of history and culture.
Okay. And then we, and listeners, I'm sorry. So we'll probably talk about a little bit more of that when we start talking about the book. When you talked about the auntie in the attic, that's right. I forgot about that.
She speaks totally in French.
Okay. I'm just going to go over some of your works, you know, and so like you've now, that you worked on, like Tales from the Umbrella Academy, You Look Like Death. I'm going to try to pronounce this other title correctly. Celeste okay, from Self-Made Heroes, and then A Shadow Out of Time. It was an H.P. Lovecraft story, again from Self-Made Hero. I know I just only picked and choose. Is there anything that you want to add, or you want to for our listeners to really check out?
There's a series called Brink, which I work on regularly. I've been doing that with a writer called Dan Abnett, and we've been working on that for a number of years now. We're on book six already, so there's quite a lot of those, and they appear in a comic in Britain called 2000 AD. And so they take a good chunk of the year when they come out, and you know, so it gets collected up. They're quite large volumes. And also working with Dan Abnett, I worked on a series for Boom called Wild's End, which is an anthropomorphic series. The basic premise of it is War of the Worlds meets Wind in the Willows. That's fundamentally what it's about. So, and then, and the Lovecraft books, I did about four of those. I kind of fell into doing those. I was hoping to do something else, but then that was the thing that sold. And so I did those for a number of years. It was a good way to kind of get used to working by myself. You know, just working with the writing and the drawing, that was good fun to do. And then it was great working with Self-Made. I did a lot of books with Self-Made Hero. They're a brilliant company. And I'm trying to think what else now off the top of my head. And of course, you know, a lot of stuff through Dark Horse and I started work. How could I forget this? I started work with Dan Abnett for Vertigo, and Karen was at Vertigo, and we worked on a series called New Dead Wardians.
I forgot to mention that.
That's how I started working with Dan. That was 10 years ago. And we've done loads of stuff since then, but so I mainly work with him. I've worked with Jared Way and Sean Simon on the Umbrella Academy book, and yeah, that's pretty much. Otherwise, I kind of do some writing on my own when I can get to it. But
Yes.
yeah.
And then now before we start getting into the interview, I want to give a few shout outs. First off, I want to give a big shout out to Hannah Bahedri of Super Fan Promotions for setting up this interview and for an advanced reading copy. So Hannah, thank you very much. ING, would you like to add anything to that too?
I'm on the spot there. I've forgotten off the top of my head. Next question. I've forgotten that, but yeah. Oh no, I've got I'm drawing a blank. I knew I would.
It's
It's
okay. It's okay. Don't worry. Don't worry.
because I did that long rest of all the other books.
Okay, don't worry. So, in preparing for this interview, I did some research, and I'll give a couple shout outs to some friends of the show. First off, Barbara Dillon. Barbara, I just want to give you a big shout out. Barbara is the from Fanbase Press. Her written article, Fanbase Press interviews INJ Colbert on the recent release of the graphic novel Salamandre. That article is up now on fanbasepress.com. It's dated December 12th of 2022. Also, too, I want to give a shout out to Brad Gullickson of the Comic Book Couples Counseling podcast. I checked out his interview. It was dated on December 3rd of 2022. That episode, if I got this correctly, is up on their Patreon site. So if you guys get a chance, please check out INJ's other interviews with Barbara and with Brad as well. So, all right. So INJ, where can listeners follow you on social media?
While it still exists on Twitter, just at INJ Colbard on Twitter. And similarly, I think it's the same. I think it's like an at when you Instagram. I can't
Okay.
remember how you Instagram, but I'm INJ Colbard on Instagram as well.
Okay. Thank you. And then I'm just gonna go just briefly, I'm gonna ask you about your origin story. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southeast London. And then I kind of, because I grew up in a, my mother's Polish. My mother was Polish, and I grew up on going to Poland a lot as a kid and then coming
Oh, okay.
back quite a lot. I
Oh,
pretty
okay.
much had every single summer was spent in Poland as a child. So, yeah. And that was during the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, really, the beginning of the 90s. I would travel over to Eastern Europe while the Berlin Wall was still standing, so it was during the
Yes.
Cold War.
Oh,
And
okay.
yeah, which is kind of the inspiration for the book, really.
Yes. Now, and then I'm gonna ask you, do you remember just like what comic series you read when you were a kid?
Read a lot of I read Marvel. I read a lot of European stuff. I read Tintin. Valerian and Laureline, which I absolutely loved. And then there was what else was there? Oh, Lucky Luke. There's tons of stuff like Asterix and a lot of Marvel stuff. I remember I used to, but I read weird stuff like I did read Werewolf by Night. I can remember number 13 was one of my first comics, actually.
Oh,
And then
nice.
there was a lot of stuff. 2000 AD. And my mother used to be a nurse, and every time they were throwing out the magazines from the
Oh,
waiting room, I
yes.
got all the comics from
Oh,
that. So she would come up
nice.
with an absolute stack of comics, and so I read loads of stuff. I used to read there was a what was a girl's comic back then that was called Misty, which was like a slightly supernatural comic aimed at girls, and that was brilliant. There was a cool story in there called The Sentinels. Loads of stuff, really. Just anything. If I had a picture and a speech bubble, I'd be reading it. So, yeah.
Sorry, I'm going off the cuff. I've always wanted to read the European Valerian? Am I pronouncing that
Valerian
correctly?
and Laureline. Yeah, that's right.
Yes, I've always wanted to read it, and I
Was amazing. You
because I
see,
know the
the time when I think it was Return of the Jedi hit the screens in the UK back in the early 80s,
Yes.
they brought out four volumes in English of Valerian and Laureline.
Yes.
And I couldn't get any more after that. And I basically then picked them up in French. And then, and so that was the only way I could access them. But I read other stuff as well. I read Thorgal, which was a Barbarian series as well. That was a European book. There was loads of stuff that I used to read. Yeah. But yeah, Valerian is fantastic. Really loved it. That was one where I used to sit in science class because the books we got, the textbooks, they were big enough to hide it inside. And so, right,
Yes,
so I used to sit there at the back reading Valerian and Laureline, looking like I was studying. It was great. I didn't do very well at science, but I draw comics, so it can't be that bad.
You were preparing for your future. That's what you were doing
Yeah,
back then, you know.
I was totally studying.
All right. And then and how did your journey start working in comics? How did that start?
Well, I always wanted to do it, but from very young. I remember one time I tried out for Vertigo when I was about 19 or 20, I want to say. And then they said, oh, this is when they had an office in London. And they said, why don't you come by with your stuff? They like the folio. And I chickened out. I couldn't do it. So I basically, I went off into, I studied film and TV. Well, no, what I did was I did an illustration course. And to the side of the illustration course, like one of the ways that you could do it was you could do an animation course. And I figured animation will lead to storyboarding, so it's kind of like comics. I'll do that because back then there were no comics courses, so I could kind of the only way in of doing comics that I could think of was to do storyboarding. So I did that, but I also love film, and so I became a filmmaker. I basically made film and TV shows, well, film and TV stuff. I made stuff to be made film and TV. I did a lot of development work, and ended up as an animation director in London. And
Yes.
that kind of, But while I was doing it, there was a lot of times when, because I ended up being a development writer and stuff for the BBC and places like that, Aardman and stuff. So I developed shows to get made. You could make a living just pitching shows, right? You just have to come up with them. But you could do that all the time. And I kind of carved out a little niche for myself doing that. But what that meant was you ended up seeing things just stuck and not actually get made. And so I can remember thinking, if I made a comic today and I just sold it, and which is what I did. I sat down one weekend and I did like a stream of consciousness comic. And it was 30, 35 or 36 pages long or something. And then I went to work. I used the photocopier, I printed 10 of them, and I went into Gosh Comics in London, and they sold all 10 of them. And I sat there and just thought, this is great because I can make something and people can see it. And it was a really kind of like punk way of doing it as well. It's just a photocopier of some staples, and just you can just go off and do it. I loved that. And so there's me trying to make TV shows that aren't getting made, but they're making comics that people are actually reading. We were crewing up once for writers for a writing room, and one of the guys that came along, he was a comic book writer at the time. He was Ian Carney. He did a series with Woodrow Phoenix called Sugar Buzz, and he showed up for the writing gig on this TV show that I'd had commissioned. And when he showed up, he said, "Oh, I recognize the style of the show. It was a comic I read, and it was my comic. He'd actually picked up a copy of it. It's crazy." Yeah, like, yeah. And I was like, oh, you're one of my 10 readers. So small world, but then I've always wanted to do it. So And then my son was born about, well, no, 17 years ago. My son was born, and I can remember just before he was born, I thought I'm going to change careers because that's the most unsensible thing you could do. You know, a child and you've got a good career in TV. And so I decided I was going to switch. But it was a good motivator because, you know, you got to feed a baby. So I decided I've got to get work. And it really drove me to do it. And yeah, and that worked out fine. So that's okay. But I think, yeah, I kind of, that was the bit where I sort of changed. And I got in a dark horse doing the new recruits program for them. I had two stories in the new recruits graphic novel that they brought out. And then also, I tried to get work at 2000 AD originally, which is where I work all the time now. But I can remember they gave me a rejection letter. And I got it on the day my son was born.
Oh God.
So of course, because I was so happy because my son was born, I remember reading this rejection letter going, this is lovely. They're so kind, you know, being really complimentary. You know, that's not a knock back, it's fine. And I was okay with it. And then but after that, I kind of yeah, knuckled down, and I had I remember meeting up with Disraeli, who's an artist for 2000 AD as well. He's done loads of stuff, and he happened to live in the same town as me. I don't know how, it was through Blogger, I think. And I contacted him and I said, oh, you live in the same town, I happen to do this stuff. I can't remember how I introduced myself. And he said, why don't we meet up for coffee? So we did, and I talked to him about what I wanted to do. I showed him the stuff that I'd done already, like the stuff I'd done for Dark Horse, and I was super critical of my own work. And he thought that was really cool, that I was able to just take my own work to pieces. But I mean, I have an art student background, so we're used to doing that. So it's not a problem. But and then he said he was meant to be drawing picture of Dorian Gray with Ian Edgington writing it. And he just contacted me and said, do you fancy drawing that? Because I'm busy doing something else. It's a 120-page book. Oh yeah. And so, and that's what self-made, and that's essentially how I started. I just basically didn't stop from that moment on.
That's
I just
nice.
worked real hard. I got 120 pages, my first thing that I had to properly do. And I remember looking at that number going, that's a lot of pages. So what I did was, yeah, I remember I made it all double page spreads, and so it, now it's just 60, right? So I was mentally breaking it down so it wasn't so scary. And then I worked like that for about three or four books. I worked in double page spreads for self-made, you know, all the time, you know, and that worked out fine. And then yeah, didn't look back. I cut my teeth doing long books, and so I got used to the whole process of turning a book around. We'd have 6 months on each book. So it was intensive, but it was good training, really, to get ready to do all the other stuff that was to come, you know. It was good fun.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for answering that question. It's like,
Yeah, it's good.
wow. But for you to,
Yeah.
to actually meet someone that lives in your town, for them to literally give you the time to
Yeah.
talk to you,
Enormously grateful. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is great. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm going to move on. We're going to move on to Salamandre. Now, before we start asking, I start asking questions, I'm going to read a quote from artist Christian Ward. Colbert is a master storyteller. I can't think of a single comic creator so adept at immersing the reader into another world. Every character, every scene, and every moment, regardless of the wild imagination of the plot or INJ's brilliantly styled artwork, is soaked in utter realism and baked in drama. Salamandre is an adventure worth getting lost in. I'm going to say I agree with that. I really,
Thank
I
you.
very good. It's I'm sorry, I'm kind of going off the cuff here. I'm not going to spoil too much, but because Christian Ward is right, because it's there's pieces of the story that I that are, you know, that are familiar to me, familiar, you know, that me as a reader is familiar, but yet it's like, or in the first page, it's you show like two maps, and then you see the the science teacher. He has the globe, so we know that it's not taking place on Earth, and it's not set on Earth, but it's familiar. And then once I forget all, you know, because once that's out of the way, you know, it's you, then I'm in this world, and yet it's recognizable. It's slightly different, but I still recognize it, and I know, and the characters have the same feeling as what most of us go through, what we deal with, happiness, sadness, loss, grief, and hope at the end. So yeah. So
Yeah, that's great. I had a with that opening bit, I had I was trying to convey straight away, this is, yeah, like you said, it's not the same place, but it's kind of familiar to you. I had that experience as a kid just traveling, because I traveled a lot as a child. And when we used to just very simple, small stuff, like we'd be traveling by car one time, and we'd pull up in Holland, or we stop in Germany somewhere, and we just go to a gas station and go in, and things would be kind of like how we do it at home, but slightly different, right? And it's that trying to catch on to, is that essentially things are kind of the same everywhere, but just a little bit different. That's all it is. It's no big deal.
Oh
Yeah,
my.
I love I that sense. I remember as a kid, I used to pretend. There was one time we pretended I was just in a slightly different parallel universe to her. Yeah, I loved it. It was great. Yeah.
But
And
the.
it, because the other thing is, when you get to another country, especially if you're living there for a while, you have to accept the food, right?
Yes.
And whatever, however the food is, that is how you're going to be eating now for the next 6 weeks or whatever. And that's a key thing. That's like, because that's changing you when you're there, you know, like that's a big deal. And I remember having that because, of course, the food culturally very different to the UK in terms of what they eat. I mean, the closest thing that Polish cuisine is to probably Korean food. It's because we have dumplings, we have noodles, we have pickles. It's essentially the same food, right? Okay. So when you go, but I would say that it's the same, it's just harder. It's a little bit harder, because if you put buckwheat in with some of that, then it becomes a lot more dense. But it's fundamental. It's that kind of cuisine. And but when you're there, it's quite different on your stomach as well. So it's like when you eat K food, it's like there'll be preserves, you know, preservatives and stuff like that. Whereas in Poland, the food's basically organic. So you are eating fresh stuff, and it's going to be quite heavy, and it's like, you know. So I used to love that subtle difference as well, you know. And culturally, like we'd have, I still have this now, where on Christmas Day we have like a Polish spread, and that's like cold meats and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's very like, we have a salad and stuff like that. So it's, yeah, I really like the cuisine over there. So yeah.
No, but I love how you pointed out that it's, you know, even in your book, you know, it's a different, it, literally, it's a different world. But even, but for us in reality, just going to, like you said, just going to a different country, there's things that are still familiar, but yet it's different. But yet it's pretty much the, you know, there are things that we recognize, and it comforts us, you
Yeah,
know.
that's right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but that's a great way to put it, though, because you know, that is a really great way to put it. I'm sorry, ING. I'm gonna start continuing on, because if not, we're gonna start digressing to other things, you know.
No worries.
All right, so now before, you know, before we start talking about the story, at the end of the book, there's a picture of your father, and it's dedicated to them. May I ask, can you talk about the dedication to your father?
Yeah, there was something about the book when when I was making it, I was really, because the character Swan Salomon is based on him.
Yes.
But my father was someone who he was like everybody had a tall tale about him. Right?
Yes.
And my parents separated when I was quite young. I was about 7 years old. And so I didn't grow up with him mm-hmm. in that sense. I did at some point, I just didn't remember. That's mm-hmm. the thing. Wow. So I didn't really have memories of him. And so he's like an idealized version of that in a way. And yeah. I think one of the things I was trying to do was to kind of get something back from that. And as I was doing the book, and he kept popping up in the book, I mean, to put it this way, he passed away before I got to see him about 28 years ago now, and 23 years ago nearly now. And he passed away. I went to his funeral. My whole life I've been told I look just like him. So when I showed up at his funeral, I think everybody thought he'd showed up for his own funeral. So, and we'd been estranged from him for years, like 20 mm-hmm. odd years by this point, because I was about 27 when he passed away. Mm-hmm. And I remember being there, and after the funeral, at the wake, everybody in the building was talking about him. And because his stories about him mm-hmm. Were just bigger than, you know, big, tall tales about him. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a story about him, and I didn't have any because I didn't have a memory of it. Mm-hmm. But what I found out was that as I was doing the book, the scenes where he's in them, I remember there was like one bit I had left to do with him in it. And I was really struggling to finish these pages. Like, they were taking weeks. Like, you know, they were taking a long time. And then I realized that what I was trying to put off was not drawing him tomorrow. And it really hit me that for years I thought I had no memories of him at all. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that, because the book talks about this quite a bit, is that it pops up and memory comes up quite a lot in the book. But what memories actually are emotions. So emotions will prompt a memory from your childhood or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, and the actual telling of the memory, when we say to somebody, oh, there's this time when I was down the shop and stuff, all that stuff's made up. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do, so every time we tell someone the story, it kind of changes, because that stuff we kind of make on the fly. Neurologically, that's actually what's going on in your head. But what you're trying to express is the emotion.
Yes.
The emotion is the true story, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I did was, with this book, I leaned hard into the bit we make up. So that's mm-hmm. why it's kind of not a real place and it's not real names. And mm-hmm. I go really into that. But at the heart of it, it is a true story. Mm-hmm. And I realized that with that in mind, because that's essentially what the book is, I realized when I was not going to be drawing him the next day, it suddenly occurred to me that I did have memories of him. Mm-hmm. They were just emotional ones. They weren't biographical. I don't remember sitting in a car with him, but I absolutely remember how I felt about him. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit that stayed with me. And I just thought, as you know, if we do art, it's always great if you can get something back from the art. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was very much that. So that dedication then went into the book at the very end as a consequence of that feeling, because I just thought, this is mad. I didn't expect this from my own work, you know. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, yeah, it was amazing.
I'm going to ask an off-the-cuff question. It's not written on before I start going to details, because like you mentioned about when you went to your dad's funeral, everybody had these tall tales about him. In the book, Casper is the young boy. He's the central character in the story. Mm-hmm. And then he's the one that has all these tall tales about his father.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Because, and he can take those away, because I can remember things like, because my father worked in Dubai for a chunk of time, and there's a lot of stories about things that he did out in Dubai, you know, and it just, a lot of them are just tall tales, you know, they're just made up, but it's fine, you know, at the heart of it, somewhere there's a truth. Yeah. You know, that's the thing of it.
And then also too, the other, I forgot to write this down, but also too, because Casper is an artist. he creates his own comic, and the main hero of his story is his dad. Was that?
Yeah.
I'm going to try. I don't. You can elaborate more, or you can. But was that a conscious effort on your part for Casper to make, you know, his father Swan the main character of his comic book? Was that a?
Yeah, I felt that, like, in that, because it's more of an idealistic notion of what my dad, if I, the kind of memories that I made from the emotions. But it's like, if that was the case, that probably would be the situation. You know, I was talking about, it's funny, because one of the things that struck me was, I grew up in a family where I was the only boy, basically, because my dad wasn't there. So I was with my grandmother, my mother, and my two sisters, and various aunts as well. Like, that's terrible. And I can remember that the one of the things that struck me was when I drew the scene in the kitchen, it's a square table.
Yes.
Now, I grew up in a house with a round table, right? And the funny thing is, it's like, so when you sit down at a table, there's no hierarchy. Nobody sits at the head of the table.
That's right.
Yeah. I used to go to friends' houses, and their dads used to sit at the heads of the table. And that always struck me as a bit weird, because I didn't get, why does he get to sit there? What's that about? And yet he does exactly that in the book. He sits at the head of the table. Technically, he's, because he's closest to the kitchen, behind him is just serve the food up. But I thought, I wonder if that's like a subconscious thing of how I see families where there's a dad in the family, because I grew up thinking it was weird that dads got to do that. There was numerous times where I'd visit a friend's houses and I'd have the dad come in and shoo me out of that seat.
I'm sorry.
You know? You know? And I can remember, like, thinking just how bizarre that was. But then now, like, weirdly, as an adult, and I hadn't realized I'd done this, but my kitchen table in my house is around, I'm raising two boys and we've got, it's a round table. There's no hierarchy around that table. So they didn't grow up with that either. So yeah, it's a bizarre thing. It's like small, but I thought about it in that, you know, in terms of those sorts of things as well, you know, how would it be? And I think that, you know, and those things kind of came out naturally.
Yes.
And the sort of things you don't realize that you kind of take for granted, but that's what people and families tend to do, you know?
Yeah. Right. Now, for our listeners, I'm going to ask you, you know, for our listeners, can you tell us what the story is about?
So it's a young boy who loses his father and loses himself in his grief. And he's sent to a country which has lost its ability to express itself artistically, because it's been taken over by a totalitarian regime. So it suppresses any kind of artistic expression. And so he goes to this country to kind of recover after the loss of his father by going and staying with his grandfather in this place. And it has secret police in it. It's got resistance. It's got all sorts of stuff. And it talks a lot about art and the importance of art and the importance of memory and things like that, not forgetting things and that kind of stuff. So,
And then before I start getting into asking about certain some characters and stuff like that, what inspired you to write this story?
So I pitched loads of stories to Karen. And every single one of them was falling apart and failing. And then I got to a story that looked like it was going to happen. I remember doing the breakdown for it, and it just fell apart during the breakdown. It wasn't working. And I was trying to get to that whole thing of establishing a connection with the story and being able to get to the heart of something, emotional, talk about emotional content. And I rang my sister, who's a novelist, and she said, she's a writer and a novelist. And I said to her, how do I make people cry, or, you know, anything like an emotional thing? Because it's the honesty, it's the truth of the story and stuff like that. And she said, take a situation from your childhood, a dramatic event, make that your finale, and work backwards from there. And that's literally what I did. So I took an incident that happened which is in the finale of the story.
Yes.
And I asked myself the question, what was the responsible adult in the room at the time thinking? Mm-hmm. And then I worked out what that might have been, mm-hmm, by going backwards. But by taking actual scenes from my childhood and reinterpreting things and then piecing them all together into this, essentially, a story, it's drawing on a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point where it goes off into the tall tale of what happens in those, you know, the, each of those scenes. But
yes,
mm-hmm, the fundamental beginning of those scenes, that's all true. That actually happened. So I had things to definitely pull from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, I mean, you know, just going over those summers, they were quite eventful. You know, mm-hmm, we had loads of experiences. We'd go mountain climbing. And I can remember once we got lost in the clouds in the mountains because we were coming down at the end of the day and there was this ridge we were walking, mm-hmm, on, which was about half a meter across. And all of a sudden the clouds, you know, the air is coming up. And so there's, mm-hmm, big, thick white clouds, yes, coming up the side of the mountain. And,
mm-hmm,
you get covered in, mm-hmm, you know, you're covered in, you can't see your hands, let alone the ground beneath your feet. So you have, mm-hmm, to stay still. And then it clears, and the sense of vertigo that you get when you've suddenly been able to see the sheer drop on both sides of the mountain, you know,
mm-hmm,
all that kind of stuff we got to do. I mean, we traveled all over the place and we did loads of amazing things that when I came back and we did our, what did you do this summer?
Yes, report, yeah. From, yeah.
Like, it looked like I was making it up. So, like, you know. Yeah.
And then
so it was cool.
And forgive me, I may have missed it, but I know we talked about a little bit in before we started the interview. Yeah. The summers when you're a kid, you travel, mm-hmm, all over Europe, but there was, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm, you mentioned that you and your family went back to Poland a couple,
yeah,
during the summers, right?
Yeah, and, yeah, that's right. My mother was Polish, so we'd travel across. We'd either go by plane,
mm-hmm,
train, or, mm-hmm, by car. Plane, train, or automobile, but we would do either one.
Yeah, no, yes.
And we used to go the train, the car, or bus. That was another one. Mm-hmm. So we used to do different journeys across, but it always, unless it was the plane, it always involved going through the border at Berlin, or at some point, there was a certain other checkpoints you could, okay, go through the Berlin Wall, effectively. So that's the Iron Curtain, that in, yes, the book is the Iron Veil, and that's the Iron, mm-hmm, Curtain, basically. And so yeah, that's where that came from.
Okay.
But, yeah. So we used to, there was a number of times where, I mean, the scene in the train station where he comes, yes, out to, that happened. There was I mean, I wasn't hiding anything, but we did, oh, have our couch turned over. We had to stand there. There were guards with guns and dogs, and it's, yeah, quite scary. And that is a ghost station. It's called that because of the fact that the trains don't officially stop there. You just get searched.
Yeah.
And they come on and check for tickets,
mm-hmm,
and that was the crazy thing too. We crossed that, and it was always seemed to fall at midnight when you crossed it, but that meant that all the neon lights of West, mm-hmm, Berlin, you crossed over to East Berlin, it was just dark.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be dark until morning the whole, mm-hmm, journey. So it was, yes, a weird sort of, it felt like you really were crossing midnight,
mm-hmm,
into some place. It was bizarre going by train, but yeah, it was a, it was a harder journey as well as a kid than Casper had, because I had to catch a boat first. So it was, oh, a boat, God, to Holland.
Well, that's right, yes, yeah.
And a Russian PKS train all the way that is bound for Moscow,
mm-hmm,
but you get from Warsaw along the way. Yeah. So I had to, and I used to travel on my own quite a lot. So, mm-hmm, yeah, that also happened. But I think, I can't remember how old I was. Very young, I think. We used, mm-hmm, to fly alone, well, often. So,
mm-hmm,
yeah. And it was because my mother was a nurse, so,
mm-hmm, yeah,
she would have to get rid of me for the summer. So that was why I ended up in Poland often. Yeah, I even went when Chernobyl happened.
Oh God!
So we had acid rain over there, so we had to take these, like, the iodine tablet that we had to take. I don't know if you've seen the TV show.
No.
Chernobyl, but they had to take these big chunky tablet there. That was horrible. It's like something to give a horse.
Oh God.
It was huge.
Yeah.
We had to take these tablets for to avoid, because it could be in the food we were eating or in the water.
The radiation, yeah.
Acid rain, yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So, INJ, already you've talked about your experience in this, going in the summer, going to Poland and so forth. And this is a perfect segue to, can you tell our listeners, so basically, I'm just gonna, well, I'm adjusting the question a little bit, but so is Casper in the story? Is that you, somewhat you, like you in the story? Oh.
That's a much more polite version of me. I was a lot less patient than him. The scene where the guy on the train won't move his bags, well, that actually happened to me. The guy, one, was much ruder than the guy on the train. The guy was actually a horrible guy. But I took his briefcase and threatened to throw it out the window if he didn't put his bags in the corridor. So that was slightly different. Yeah, I was a lot more confrontational than Casper. Yeah, I was rude to people, but only if they were rude to me. I
It's
wasn't nearly as nice as Casper, though.
all right. And then I'm gonna ask if you can like Casper's mother, Eloise, is that based on anyone or is it just,
No, that's it. It was more that it was like, I think the two characters in it, really, the grandfather is almost a replica of my actual grandfather in Poland at the time, because he did used to keep snapdragons in his pockets, and he used to explode them behind people, and he was
I'm sorry.
incredibly childish, right? And so kids loved him because he was just really childish. And then my dad, so the and of course Swan Salomon's very much based on my dad, yeah. On what people used to, I mean, what people used to tell me about him, but yeah, basically. So it was, yeah, it was quite, it's funny because, like, my older sister says that, in a lot of ways, I am just like my dad was, you know. So when building that character, there's elements of him and how he is with how I am with my own sons. So it was a lot of drawing on that, just experiences of my own from being a dad. So I had to build him up in that way. But you know, this the vibe of him is, I think, pretty much spot on. That's definitely how I feel that he was, you know. get my drift. But yeah. But Eloise, no, my mother was a nurse, so not quite the same character. But and yeah, it was, I never had to go abroad like Casper does, because there was, you know, it, not for the same reasons as Casper's situation. It was more convenient for a nurse working for the NHS.
But I to me, I'm just saying it because I because just listening to you talk about it's just looking kind of like hearing what you're saying, and you can look back and said, basically there were adventures. Like you said, you'd be hiking and you guys be in the clouds and you're because I'm not going to experience that.
No.
I not like most people in the world are not going to experience things, but you have experienced it,
Yeah. I think
and
it's like when you draw on stuff like that, what I was trying to do with it was to really tap into how we all feel about losing someone.
yes.
Or, and it isn't just about how we might lose someone, but also how we might lose some aspect of ourselves due to ill health, or some
Yes.
aspect, or our jobs, or something. You know, it's that kind of thing where it taps into how it's a much more broader sense of what grief is. Because I can remember as a kid, I mean, to put it in perspective, as a kid, I'd had technically lost my dad when I was 7, and because. So, you know, all those years building up to before he actually died. That's why in the story he's in a submarine. He's technically not dead, because he's just somewhere nobody can reach him. And that was very much my experience as a kid. But that is grief, right? So for a child who loses a parent that way because they can't see them, they're estranged from them, or even if the parent's in prison or something like that, then it's, you know, that in and of itself is a sort of loss because they don't get to see them. Or they might lose them because they've, you know, the parent might have dementia or something. And then so the so immediate so it changes how, when you eventually lose someone, how that loss feels in a way, because you kind of have the shock of loss isn't really there because you've had it over a long period of time. So it's a very different kind of grief. And it's for one that people don't tend to recognize as a loss either. So you won't get the sympathy from somebody, you know, who says, I'm very sorry for your loss if you've, you know, your dad has left. You know, they're not going to say that. But it's fundamentally, it's the same sort of thing, really, especially to a kid, you know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it was looking at the way that grief, we look at grief as well. So the way that we understand it. Loss is loss. And it's really, it's the same for everybody. It could be a pet. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. we all experience it. So hopefully what I've tried to do is convey something that's a very common, you know, common language thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter where we're from, who we are, mm-hmm. it's going to hurt like this, you know, or it's going to be like this for you, or, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's going to hurt fundamentally.
Yeah.
You know.
Couple things. I'm going to start moving on. Sorry. One character I want to touch upon mm-hmm. is in the Iron Veil, Casper meets I'm going to butcher her name wrong.
Is it Melisande?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask, was Cruella de Vil some type of part of an inspiration for her? Because
the white hair?
not only the white hair.
Right.
Her and Casper and Delphine go into her house. Mm. And I'm sure if you would have, you would have drawn 101 cats.
Yeah. She was based on an artist that painted in Poland that my grandmother knew. Oh. And she was a woman who, my grandmother paid her to paint all our portraits, right?
Nice.
And so we would go and sit for her, but her house was full of cats. Right? So you went to go and sit down on a chair to go and sit for the painting, and you had to move the cats out of the way constantly, fighting for seats. So that's based on a real person. But I don't actually, I can remember doing that, but I can't remember the person really. So what I did was, she is like an amalgam of practically every art teacher I ever had that was good. So rolled them all into this one person. But there's also an aspect of my own view of what I was doing career-wise at times, and, you know, mm-hmm. wishing I'd got back to certain things, and because that definitely comes up for artists all the time, you know. So she was an element, there were elements of her that were parts of me, and also a lot of art teachers, you know.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. My next question is, because this to me, because I noticed this in the story, is like, what is the significance of Swan's good luck watching the story? Because it's carried through, because I see when Casper is either sleeping or he's ready to fall asleep, you have the words very vivid, tick, 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 tick. Is there any significance to that, or?
Yeah, primarily it's the passage of time.
Okay.
It's that whole idea of like life keeps going on regardless. The watch hasn't stopped when he passed away. It just is still going. But it's also the constant reminder. You're not going to forget this. You're not going to forget this. It's the constant background reminder of that going on. So it is two things. And it also is used as a stress thing as well. Mm-hmm. So it's very much like a stress-related element too. So it was, you know, when things are building up, mm-hmm. then that comes into play as well. But yeah, it was, the significance was to do with just the passage of time. Mm-hmm. People coming out, you know, not being there or being reminded of them perpetually, you know, because mm-hmm. there's moments where he's trying to forget things in his mind, and he's trying to put things to the side, and he can't ever really forget. But there's also other reminders, like the cards on the wheels, they go tick, tick, tick. The indicator on the truck is mm-hmm. tick, 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 because it won't switch off. And so there's always something that's reminding him all the way through.
All right.
And it's quite telling as to when it's not there at the same time, because obviously there's moments where it's away, and it's not there. And so, yeah, it does come up.
Okay. Now, behind the Iron Veil, you know, you have that, you know, they can't have flowers. There's no flowers. There's no music.
Yeah.
Basically, no freedom of artistic expression. You know, is there a deeper symbolic meaning in the story? Like, part of me wants to ask you, why did you pick those? You know,
yeah, I think it's to drain the world. It's to drain the world of any kind of color, or there's a certain, the beauty of the world is something that doesn't matter where you're from, like you can share aspects of that. Like, so for example, a universal language is music, right? So dance, or just anybody getting a rhythm on, that's like, you get that everywhere. So all those unifying things are taken away. So you can't have those because you're not to unify in that way. You know, it's that sort of thing. And there was other aspects of it, like things like the but I like brutalist architecture, I've got to admit. But the idea that like a concrete box of a house has no characteristic about it. It has function, but it doesn't have any history. So it's eradicated any sense of history of the place by replacing everything that did have character and history with something that has nothing. There's a big amount of that in the 1960s in the UK after when they were repairing, after the Second World War, when they were repairing parts of London, and they were looking at concrete everywhere. So there's sections in London, like the South Bank Centre and the Barbican and stuff like that, which were, I feel, I know it's the South Bank Centre, but they were basically concrete everywhere. And there was a, there was a writer called J.G. Ballard who was objecting to it all the time because he felt that it was a, that to him was what was becoming of the future. And he at one point said the future is boring because it, and it does drain out a sense of character and history, especially in a central place like London, to have those things happen. But now, since then, those places have become a part of that as well. They've developed their own history, and they have a sense of character as well. So, but I wanted to be able to pick something that was quite devastating to that notion of, you know, historical value. That's why, so the, you know, the artistic quarter has got all these old buildings and character in it, color, and then you get to this new place which is just devoid of color and haven't got anything about it.
Yeah.
So I mean, anything to kill the imagination, basically. That was the subjective. And I was also looking at the way that in communism, you know, it worked well. And I say that, I say in terms of the way that Soviet artists were used in propaganda to sell a vision of the future. But then once those parties got in place, they just essentially undermined all that and got rid of the art afterwards. But always when you look at those things, they're always looking off into the distance, the sculptures. And it was always interesting to me the way that there was, because they're trying to make you think about the future rather than the present right now, the terrible conditions and things like that. So it was the way in which art was used. So when we come back to that thing about Melisande, it's about the way that artists are used to convey things as not as the way that they actually are. They're not true. They're sort of just, they're depicting something that's a lie, effectively. And an artist's duty, as I see it, is to truth. And so it's really important that that's the way she kind of sums up the whole thing of like, when she's talking about statues and tearing down statues. The important thing in that is that it is, to me, it's the life of a statue is... It's put this deeply symbolic reason why they put the thing up politically is equally a symbolic reason to tear it down. So, you know, it is the life of a statue. That's that its destruction is inevitable because that's what it was put up for. So that we address what the issue was, take it back down. That's the life of a statue. To me, it is. That's the artistic life of it.
No, I'm sorry because, I'm not going to spoil it, but now I understand when Casper and Delphine go back to Melisande's home. There's that one, you know, I'm not going to spoil it, but now I know why. One thing I wanted to ask, and it's an off the cuff question, is because in the story, you know how Eloise and Casper, they talk about the Iron Veil. It sounds like this dreaded place. You know, we go with Casper there, and it's not drab. It's not, you know, it's not, you know, we don't, you know, we don't see these long lines, red lines, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember, you know, in the 80s, we used to hear about red lines, you know.
In, yeah, I stood in one. They were very long. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, but when I see, you know, his grandfather's home, it looks like, it almost kind of looks like a home, you know, that's not inside the Iron Veil. Or when he could, when they go visit Auntie's home, you know. So I mean, because we talked about it a little bit before, and if you're okay talking about it, we talked about it a little bit before, but when you said when you've like gone inside the wall, the homes are pretty much, there was a warmth to it. They had their own cultures inside. So, you know, was that intentional in the story to make sure that, you know, there wasn't this drab place? It just looks like, you know, anywhere else in the world.
I think it's like when you have that level of people kind of have a view of it where it just seems like, because the view of the, I think the Western view of the Eastern Bloc in the 80s and the 70s and the 80s was that it was all, everything must have been black and white, you know. It's really black. But once you got in the homes of people, they're warm, they're full of culture and character, and the person's dignity, a sense of self-dignity, you know, their own, you know, and the hospitality was always there and really warm and welcoming.
Yes.
You know, because the heart of the person is not gone. Mm-hmm. You know, that is like, you know, I think they always make it sound so horrible, but in actual fact, the apartments inside were really nice. Like, they were really nice and warm and welcoming. So it was an attempt to kind of, I don't think it was an attempt. It was just how I remembered it, really.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I think it was not trying to show it in any particular light. It was just kind of what it was like. It was, you know, the houses were warm and welcoming, and much to the contrast of how they may have appeared on the outside, if there were these concrete blocks and things like that. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I had an uncle who lived in one of those buildings on the outskirts of Warsaw, and inside it was really cool, really nice, you know, apartment that he had. You know, the family, the love in the family is still there, and the sense of dignity the family has is just, you know, not stripped away. I think it's possible anywhere as well. I think it's just, you know,
That's right, because when Casper meets his auntie and uncle and his cousin Delphine, that's right, because now I'm looking back, it's like, you know, the auntie's always loving, she's always, you know, she's you can tell, and also there's a strong mother bond relationship between the auntie and Delphine, because she's always going, you know, oh yeah, Casper, we're saying this because Delphine wants to make sure that you're coming home tonight or something, and you hear Delphine go, ma, you know. That nice loving relationship.
Yeah, because the kitchen I think you spend a lot of time around people's lounge or kitchen tables, you know, it's like, not lounge tables, dining tables or kitchen tables. You spend a lot of time in that environment where it's the heart of the house.
Yes.
You know, and fundamentally what you are sat with is the heart of the home and the family itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so you share a moment in that, like the love and warmth around that table from that family. Yes. You're going to be privy to it. Even when it's like where they're shouting at each other or something like that, you know, because every house is like that. And I like that, is that when we interact with other people's places of, you know, we go to someone's house, we're welcomed to the place where the heart, the hub of the house is, you know, the heart of the house actually is, which is usually the, you know, the dining table or the kitchen table, that sort of thing. I quite like that. You know, that's something I was trying to definitely push across.
Oh, okay. No, but thank you very much. Sorry, INJ, I'm going to try to start moving us along.
No worries. That's fine.
Yeah. So, now I love, now I'm not spoiling too much, but a note is given to Casper by Millicent, and I love part of her quote from this note. You know, I want to thank you, Casper, for reminding me, for waking up my imagination, because it takes imagination to remember the past, and it takes imagination to picture a better world, and I want and to want for a better future. I just love that. I just love that. That was great. That was one of the things that stuck with me from the book, you know.
Yeah, that's great.
You know.
I think it's like, I think it's really important to be able to access the imagination in that way, to be able to, because it is about like remembering stuff is about imagining. Because like I
Yes.
was saying, we don't really re when we remember stuff, we kind of build it up. So
Yeah.
it's important to tell tales around the table. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. What's important is that the heart of it's true, but all the stuff we sort of confabulate those stories as we tell them, but they are really fundamentally important. And they are, I think about the fact that, like, when people say, oh, I couldn't tell a story, but we tell stories all the time. We do it all the time. Whether we come home from work and give an anecdote about something that happened at work, or somebody gossiping about somebody. That's, I mean, who doesn't love gossip? It's like, yeah, it is looking at that and thinking how important that is, but also recognizing how the imagination, how important it is to, that's the thing that's going to help you further down the line. In terms of thinking of a way out of this, you need the imagination to be able to do that. So exercise it, make a story up. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to start slowly wrapping things up. So how did you team up with Karen Berger again for this book? Because I know you correct me if I'm wrong, you worked with her about 10 years ago with Vertigo. And because you got to correct, so yeah, so how did you team up with her for this book? And I know you mentioned that you were giving her stories already, or pitches.
So we worked on everything. So basically what happened was she got in touch with me in 2018 and said that she was working on a book with Christopher Cantwell. That's what I forgot to mention earlier. Christopher Cantwell. So and she said the book was called Everything. And she wanted me on as the artist. And I said yes before I'd even looked at the things because I just really wanted to work with her. But luckily, Chris's story is fantastic. Really enjoyed it. And working with him was an amazing experience. It was brilliant. And of course, working with her and the team at Boga Books was fantastic as well. Because I learned a huge amount from doing that. And the thing is, all the stuff I learned, just technical stuff as well. There was a coloring method. Adam Pruitt, who is one of the people at Boga Books, and he talked me through the whole process of the coloring process for Dark. We just worked with each other on that really closely. So I learned a ton from that, to be able to put that back into everything else I do, like when I'm working on Brink or whatever. And just a lot of stuff. Just it was just a brilliant way to work. And then after we'd finished those, she mentioned wanting to work on more stuff. And then she said, "Have you got anything you want to be able to write?" So I did. I then started pitching like crazy. I'm not gonna let this one get away. And then out of that came this basically. So that's how that happened. But yeah, I couldn't believe my luck. I mean, the thing is, it's like I've loved the stuff that Karen's been doing since Swamp Thing, and one of my favorite early books that they did was Enigma, which was for Vertigo Books, and it was Duncan Fragredo artwork, and Milligan was the writer on it, Pete Milligan was, and I love that book, and I loved loads of books because during that period of time, there was a lot I loved about cinema, and there was a lot. This is in the early to mid 90s that I loved about cinema, and a lot that I loved about books at the same time. And you know, I mean, there was a lot of stuff at the time. There was all that. I mean, Pulp Fiction had come out, and so I mean, Vertigo was your comic of choice. You know, the comic publisher of choice at the time in terms of if you, Tarantino, or that, those kind of movies, and Jim Jarmusch movies as well, because I love Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, and all those sorts of films were coming out in the 90s, and just the Vertigo stuff was fantastic in a kind of, because the way I look at it is that you've got film and you've got literature, and right in the middle of those two is comics, because it can do both.
Yes.
And I that's what I love about the medium, more than anything. Having worked in film, I really love working in comics, because you've got so much that you can do. That you, you know, such a broad amount of things that you can pull off. So I love working that way. But yeah, so, and I'd always wanted to work with her. And when I was 19, and I actually went to the Vertigo, I think I was 19, something like that. And I went to the Vertigo thing in London, and I chickened out. I can remember thinking to myself, before I hit 40, I have to have done a Vertigo book. Like, and I was fast approaching 40.
Yeah.
And I remember I just managed to get New Deadwardians done just before my 40th birthday, so I did it. But then, and then just to get to work with her at all after that was just like, because obviously Vertigo closed down, and I just thought, that's it, not gonna get to do this again. And then out of the blue I got this email. Well, it wasn't an email, it was through Twitter. She sent me a DM, because I'm just not contactable any other way. So, and then, and yeah, she got hold of me, and then we started working on this stuff, and it's just been brilliant. It's been really good to work with her. And every time I do a book, I learn a hell of a lot, like I did from this, you know, in terms of it as a work of art, working, you know, what you get from art, that that was huge. It was, it was a big surprise. So it was, it's been fantastic. Every time, you know, we're in the moment, we're in communication, because we've got, I'm pitching something at the moment. And it's very early stages, but it's getting there. And then we're talking a lot about that right now. So we're going to be doing it again.
Oh, but nice.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. It's been, I've been really fortunate in this career to have worked with the best people easily. You know, I've just lucked out every step of the way. Yes. It's just been brilliant. I mean, working with Matt Smith at 2000 AD, Daniel Shaven at Dark Horse, that working with... Now, meeting Disraeli, like I did way back when he put me onto that book, working with Edgington, working with Dan Abnett, just been really lucky, you know. It's been great, you know. So yeah,
that's really nice. I know right now you're in the early stages of something right now. I know you can't talk about that. I'm going to ask: Is there any future project that you're okay talking about right now? Are you currently
working? I'm working on, the only one I can really mention is that I'm working on the next series of Brink. That's unfortunately all I can talk about.
I can't really
say what the other Garen Berger project is, but it will be if it works out. I never assume it will do, so I always play that one like, oh, this isn't going to work. It's the best way to do it. But yeah, if that happens, fantastic. I'll be really pleased. But there's more stuff coming along all the time. Yeah.
All right. So INJ, I'm slowly wrapping things up. Do you have a favorite convention moment, whether as a fan or as a creator?
Oh, that's a really good question. Oh, man. As a creator, I guess generally, like, it's really good when people come up and sit down and have a long conversation with you at your table.
Yes.
It's notable. But I get to do stuff in France. I'm published in France as well. And the sheer, like, range of people that come and read your books in terms of the demographic, it's so broad, it's like, it's massive. So it's, that's really cool.
That's nice.
And But it also the demographic generally in the comics in the UK has changed a lot over the years as well. Since I started, it's kind of like it's good to see, like just in terms of age, you know. Yeah,
Yes.
but I love it that when you're in like France, you've got somebody who's like 8 years old comes up, and then you got somebody who's 88 years old comes up. It's just that's fantastic. But yeah, I think yeah, and as a fan, that's a really hard one. I never go up and say hello to people. I get really nervous about saying hi to people whose work I love, and it's like, can you sign this? Okay, bye.
It's
I
okay.
know you're gonna say too much. And yet, on the other end of it, if I'm sitting there, somebody comes up for something, I like to have a good chat. So it's really nice,
That's
but it's
nice.
great. I remember one kid coming up who had surgery on his eye. He'd been in hospital for a long time, and this is a kid in France who came up and he'd been reading my books while he was in the hospital. It was just really sweet to know that those books were something he really enjoyed while he was having a miserable time in the hospital. You know, it's just really nice to know that he was reading stuff that I'd done. That was just, it felt real like honor to have been the book that he was actually reading. That's really kind, really nice. There's lots of things like that. Yeah. People are really good when they come up as well. They're really nice. So, yeah.
Do you have next convention or store signing appearance in 2023?
2023, all I know about is that I'm at Angoulême, which is the French festival, which I'm going to be in Lyon as well and Paris towards the end of January. But other than that, nothing else, I don't think. Yeah. I tend to be at home drawing. I never get anywhere.
All right. Two more questions. Have you and your family been to Hawaii?
No, but I'd love to go. Yeah. No, it looks amazing, but I definitely would love to go. That's something, yeah. Like, is it Waikiki Beach? And you get a view of Diamond Head from Waikiki? Yeah. That's something that there's quite a few times. Yeah, I'd love to be there and be able to see that and just walk along that beach and be able to see it. That'd be amazing. But there's a lot of that. Yeah.
So, okay, now I'm making it clear to listeners, and if Karen Berger's listening, I'm just making fun of, I'm just this is a joke. So, ING, what you do is your next pitch to Karen, hey, I've always wanted, there's a story about this guy. He
Yeah.
lives in Hawaii. Yeah.
I got this idea for Waikiki Beach.
I think me and my wife, we need to be
Yeah.
in Hawaii for 3 months for because we need
Yeah.
to do accurate research,
A lot of research, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And
No, good.
I'm sure Karen's gonna go, if you do that, I'm there with you. Where
Yeah,
every
I'm
Friday
gonna
would
spend
be,
the budget on this one. That'd be great.
every Friday would be like a my time. It would be that my time meeting where you guys catch up on what the story's about.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I would not say no to that. I would definitely leave home for that. Yeah, come to Hawaii. That'd be brilliant.
I'm gonna say if you do, if well, I'll change the subject a little bit, but if you guys do come to Hawaii, I think usually because basically we don't have seasonal changes. All we have is basically summertime when it's hot, wintertime is the rainy season. That's basically it, you know.
Yeah.
When it gets cold, it's not, it's not freezing cold, where there's no snow,
Yeah.
if you ever come across some newspaper article about, oh, it's freezing in Hawaii, it's 50 degrees or something, that's where you
Yeah.
just kind of laugh and go, That's April. You know, it's April for us.
Yeah.
That's sure.
No, it's
Yeah.
very, it's really cold here. It's minus, well, I don't know what it's, I don't know what the Fahrenheit Celsius conversion is. It's very cold
So much.
right now. Yeah,
Wow.
it's really bad over here. But and then in the summer we had impossibly hot as well.
Yes,
So
I've heard.
our houses are built for cold weather, really. Well, they're not even built for cold weather that well. So because it's meant to be like this country that's just raining all the time, and you know,
Yes.
it's not supposed to be that particular, and it's an island, so.
Yeah.
But it's not supposed to be that great, but it's not supposed to be so extreme. And so we're
Yes.
now experiencing the extreme ends of that sort of temperature.
Yes.
So we get real hot, real cold. But
Oh my
I mean,
goodness.
Poland's colder. I can definitely vouch for that because they
Yeah.
get Siberian winters, so they get really cold weather. But we have, yeah, it's quite cold for here. You know, yeah.
Last
So
question.
yes, I want to come to Hawaii. 100%. I think most of the people living here want to come to Hawaii.
I'm joking on this part, ING, but if your sister hears that you're coming to Hawaii to do some research, you'll be
Yeah.
going, no, I'm sorry, sis. You know, it's just me and the wife, you know, and our kids, you know.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's what you should tell your sister. Hey, you know when you know their next door, you pitch this to your publisher. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Any closing words to our listeners?
Oh, well, thank you for listening, and hope you pick up my book, and yeah, and keep on reading.
ING, mahalo. Thank you in Hawaiian. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much. I know we've gone over an hour. Just thank you
That's
very much
cool.
for your time. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to interview you. I wish you all the success with Salamandre. Again, listeners, it's out in stores right now. If you are a new comic book reader or a lifelong comic book reader, please check out Salamandre. It's part of the Burger books line through Dark Horse. It's a very good it's an original graphic novel. It's a very good story. It deals with one child's experience of going through literally the emotional stages at a very young age of Casper is 11. He goes through what his world a world of stability of his parents, both his parents, and then, when he loses his dad, he goes through like a depression, and he starts losing everything. But at the end of the story, there is a rebirth. There's hope in this, So if you guys get a chance, please pick up, and I'm going to call it's a slice of life story. It's something that touches us. It does. It affects us. So, and ING, I'm going to ask you, please just give me a moment for this because I really want to thank Drew, the host of Comics for Fun and Profit, and Hannah of Super Fan Promotions. They do all the hard work behind the scenes. Hannah sends out the press releases. She scheduled interviews, send me advance reading copies. Drew, he does the editing. He writes the promo when he posts the interviewer episodes. And he's the one that also releases the interviews as well too, but more importantly, I want to thank them both because what it is that they're expanding my comic book horizon. I still love superhero books. I love them, but stories like Salamandre, personal stories, these stories, that has a little more emotional attachment to it. It deepens my love for the hobby. And I encourage everyone who's listening to this episode, to take a chance and try to pick up something new and different in your local comic book shop. So, and I need to also do a plug for this. If you are a new listener, please check out new episodes of Comics for Fun and Profit that comes out every Saturday. And I want to thank you, the listeners. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for listening to this episode. Until next time, guys. Aloha.
The good folks at Comics for Fun and Profit have been doing 2 episodes a week for quite some time now, and it's all thanks to, first of all, Jason, and second of all, our patrons, who allow us to add the space on our server, broadcast more, store more, share more with you listeners. I'm envious of those of you who have unlimited storage and media server capabilities. We pay for ours here at the C4 FAP. It ain't cheap. We thank you so much for those of you who go to patreon.com/comicsfunprofit and contribute at any level to say thanks, to say I want to be a part of your Slack channel conversations. I want to get exclusives. I want to get early access. I want to get ad-free access. I want to get swag. I want to get some free stuff. Whatever your reasoning is, we appreciate it at any level because it does make a difference. So from the bottom of Kyle and I and Jason's heart, thank you for contributing.